Welcome to episode 18 of Launch and Learn, our last episode of 2020. How crazy is that? We made it, guys. This is a fun episode. I got to talk to my fellow University of Calgary alumni, Alexander Newth, fellow Haskaner. Shout out to Haskane School of Business. She's also a venture builder, so we had a lot in common. It was a really nice conversation. We talked about her journey into entrepreneurship, how she ended up starting a venture builder, and we talk more about her unique approach to venture building and working with freelancers and agencies. It's going to be really fun. Hopefully you take something away. Enjoy this, guys. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We'll chat next year. Well, thanks so much, Alex, for coming on the show. Always good to have a fellow venture builder on, which we'll get to, but thanks so much for coming on.
No problem at all.
Our first question, I guess we have to modify, but what did you have for breakfast today?
I haven't had breakfast yet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Too early.
Just coffee, though. I'm not much of a breakfast person.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, we can get started a bit with your entrepreneurship journey before we get into what you're up to these days. But how did you get interested in the entrepreneurship and startup space to begin with?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm based in Canada, and I'd say Canada doesn't have the strongest, we've got some entrepreneurs, but it's not as strong as a lot of other places. But I was lucky in that my family always was very entrepreneurial growing up. So I always kind of had a little bit of that bug within myself. But I went to university. I was one of the few that actually took entrepreneurship as a study discipline, which I'm not sure if you can actually really study it, but I tried and did that. And then decided to go into management consulting for a while and ended up just kind of falling more into the entrepreneurship route for most of my career up to this point and trying to figure out how to build or kind of have that same spirit within the companies I worked for. So did innovation consulting and kind of this entrepreneurship venture consulting, and then moved into working at a firm within a bank and actually doing that for them across a lot of different projects, and then running a pretty large scale entrepreneurial venture at a bank. And then started my own company just in the last year, right before COVID. So always kind of dabbled in it, always wanted to do it, but most of my career was spent doing it kind of inside semi-entrepreneurial within larger organizations.
Yeah. Can you share more about that Challenger Bank story? I think it's pretty interesting because that's probably your first glimpse into this venture building sort of scene, building companies within a company.
Yeah. Sure.
Tell us how you got started with that and how it went.
Yeah. So I was pretty lucky because I worked at a bank that was pretty innovative. It was a little bit smaller than some of the other big banks that we had in Canada. So we had a couple complications. Kind of the biggest being that we needed every dollar that we spent to be worth pretty much $10 of our competitors' dollars. So we needed to kind of punch above our weight in a pretty meaningful way. So we kind of looked around at the market, and we knew that we weren't winning with certain customer segments. We knew our tech stack was pretty old school, and we knew that there's a lot of things that we were doing that were just going to be a really long time before it was going to come to fruition. So we actually went across the pond. So we went to Europe and looked a lot at how other banks were kind of approaching it and how they had tried to solve similar problems around customer acquisition and changing the way that they actually operated the business, and kind of came across these challenger banks that kept getting built. And a lot of them were getting built by banks, but they were really kind of pushed outside of the organization. So we decided to do the same. We figured it was going to be really hard to disrupt ourselves from inside. And we were still going to do that with a team, but we wanted to create the Skunkworks team off the side and staff it with kind of younger, non-banker type people to actually go through and disrupt everything from the ground floor, from what the tech stack looked like to what the processes were, to how we worked, to how we approach problems and everything in between, and to hopefully actually drive a totally new product that was different in the market and would actually try to disrupt ourselves. And so that was kind of our contingency around all the market pressures and competition that was coming, and just the kind of realization that you can't always do it within a big transformation team with very kind of traditional bankers and traditional corporate people. So stood that up and we grew the team. It was just an idea and a business case to the board, all the way up to 150 people and a fully launched challenger bank and market within 2 years. So very fast too, a lot faster than startups would do, just because we had a lot of capital and we had a lot of resources and kind of phone a friend. So it's kind of a hybrid right in the middle between kind of what a startup was trying to do and then what a corporate could do.
Yeah. And I saw you wrote an article recently about some of your key like
takeaways from that opportunity? Yeah. We don't have to get into everything now, but what are your, like, just for our listeners, a bit of a summary there.
Yeah. So it was a tough article to write. I called it semi-failed venture. One of the things that we kind of found, because it took about 2-ish years to get out, a lot changes within big corporations in that time. You get leadership changes, you get risk appetite changes, the market changes, and you can't be hyper-focused on that outcome in the same way that, you know, startups with VC might be able to, because, you know, the organization might say, well, we've changed this aspect, or we've changed mm-hmm. the CTO, or whatever that looks like. So there's a lot of lessons I had, I think. And it was hard to kind of call it a semi-failed venture, and it was hard to write it. But I think some of the bigger lessons I had was just around talent, I think, was the big one. Talent and governance would be the two I'd pull out of it. And talent being more, it's really hard when you're pulling from internal resources at a big corporate to find the right DNA and the right people to actually go build ventures. It's a very different mindset, a very different skill set, just a very different way of working. And it's almost like you need the people that aren't good in a corporate to go do the mm-hmm. venture, because then they're going to be better at it. And so a lot of it came down to talent, I think, with where we struggled and where we could have gone better or faster or done more. And then governance too, I found, you know, with that kind of change in leadership, the change in direction, and then you always kind of had this gut reaction where something wasn't going right, you know, the behemoth of the corporation would come down and start to kind of ask for Gantt charts and metrics and all the stuff that makes them feel comfortable and makes them feel like they can have some control, when really the only thing that matters is getting to market and testing with mm-hmm. customers. But they try to almost get these like pseudo controls everywhere. And it's a lot of people that don't know what they're doing, asking questions that probably aren't the right questions, that just end up taking a lot of time and distraction from the purpose. So those are kind of my two big learnings from trying to do a corporate venture.
And then from that, I mean, what triggered you, or why did you get started to make the decision to be like, you know what, I'm going to do this myself and go independent this year?
Yeah. So As hard as building a venture is, I absolutely loved it. It was probably my happiest where what I was doing and where I was working. So as big banks do, once you kind of do one of these projects that's high risk and high challenge and you learn a lot, then they offer you a nice big role that's more traditional and boring and give you a nice path upwards. And when I was kind of looking at some of the roles that were kind of getting thrown around, it just wasn't a fit for what I wanted to do. Like, I like the growth. I like the challenge. I like saying, okay, what market or what product are we going to totally change? And just where the organization was, it wasn't going in that direction of full disruption. So I wanted to do this again. And now I had a whole bunch of stuff that I learned. And so the thought was I could go help other organizations do it. And if I could do it multiple times a year, then I would be very happy. So I decided to take the plunge and leave a couple long-term incentives and other kind of nice golden handcuffs that corporations offer you on the table and jump into building this for other people.
Cool.
Yeah. And you call yourself like a challenger consultancy. Can you explain more what that means and how like your consulting experience changed how you approach this agency kind of?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I had the, I'm not sure if it's the joys or the bad, if it's bad, but I had the big consulting experience where I worked at a huge firm and did that for a few years. And, you know, there's always the things like when you're inside any company, you're like, I would do this differently, or I don't know why it happens this way. And you hear all the jokes, like my clients would always make jokes like, oh, the school bus is pulling up with all the young analysts, or, you know, the classic consultants just take your watch and tell you the time or whatever these things were. Then I went into the venture and into the bank and hired a ton of consultants during that period. And, you know, some are awesome and some of the people were fantastic, but a lot of the times I was having to redo stuff because I was sold experts that weren't experts or sold work that they couldn't actually do. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of struggles. And so when my business partner and I decided to do this, and he came from big consulting as well, from a small firm that got bought out by a big firm and then stayed at a big firm, there's just a whole bunch of things that we didn't want to repeat. And so a lot of that was kind of around our approach. We didn't want to have a huge bench of generalists that we are billing out as experts. So what we've kind of done as the first part is kind of modular consulting. So bringing in a lot of agencies or other partners that have a lot of specialized skills to actually work with our clients. So if we're working with a liquor brand to try to build a brand new type of of alcohol that's a disruptive alcohol for the market, we're not going to bring in a generalist that worked on fintech. We're going to bring in somebody that knows alcohol and knows branding of alcohol and knows how to create these products and how to the people that have these really strong opinions in that market. So we wanted to bring in more of that expertise as opposed to a huge bench of people. And that also allows us, because we don't have the overhead, to hopefully take bigger venture or investments into ventures and kind of co-incentivize ourselves with our clients so that we can actually launch bigger, more disruptive products. And we don't need to cover any fees or any overhead. And so then we're able to kind of say, you know what, we believe in this idea. We're going to put our entire money at risk on this as well, because we can. And that's been probably kind of the second part that we really wanted to change, is just how consultants are incentivized so that our clients don't believe that we're just there to collect a check or that we're dragging things on. We're really there to be just as successful as they are.
Cool. I guess before sort of diving deeper, so what exactly is Now and Never Ventures? I mean, just sort of from an overview perspective, and you know, what is venture building for you, and you know, how do you take that first step and leap to build it?
Yeah, and we're about a year into doing this, so it's, and we built it all during COVID, so it's a little crazy. So we're still, I think we've got our problem solution fit. We're pretty there on product market fit. We're still refining it as anybody should with their proposition. So I can say where it is right now. We'll see where it is in the future. But really, we kind of have a couple different areas. One, with a lot of our clients that we're kind of starting out with, we just go in to really help them think differently. And that sounds kind of cliched, but we typically go in and do a very kind of rapid design thinking type process, really focused around ventures to say, where are some of these market opportunities that exist? What are core opportunities to your business? And where do we think that you should be investing or building ventures within that we think are growth opportunities? And so we typically do that by introducing clients to interesting people around the world that we've met. So if you're a pension fund in Ontario, we'll go find really interesting people in Australia, Asia, Europe, that are going to, whether it's startups or other kind of pension managers, that are going to really push their thinking. We do a bit of market scanning and we do a lot of customer discovery. And then we pull all that together and say, here's a couple of different concepts that are articulated that we think you should actually go test and try building as ventures that we think are really cool. So we've kind of got this more of the traditional fee income, consulting, advisory, where should you invest, what should you build, design thinking type stuff. And then the kind of the second part of Now or Never is really around building those actual ventures. So assembling these kind of experts across lots of different fields and putting together a structure to actually go build whatever these products or these concepts are for clients. And that's kind of our two pieces of work, I'd say. That's kind of our bread and butter right now.
Can you share more about this sort of like outsourcing thing where you work with different agencies from around the world? How did you structure that, I guess, to begin with, to make sure that the communication lines are good, that people know what is expected of them? I'm sure, like, I don't know, managing these different agencies around the world for one project could be quite time consuming as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we've kind of gone back and forth between, do you make it super, super formal with all these agreements and then have kind of like people have to opt in and sign all this stuff and sign their life away to be part of the network? Or do you just kind of go find the right people for each project? And we're kind of leaning more towards the latter. The big thing for us is finding those agencies that are super aligned. So typically we do like a little bit of a test where we involve them early on when we're building out some of the concepts or doing some of these interviews with experts, just to kind of get a sense of who they are and really make sure that that culture fits there. And it's not prescriptive. Like, we don't have this huge prescriptive, you have to meet all these criteria or anything like that. But in terms of the actual kind of structuring of the venture, it's one of the things too we found was procurement's one of the biggest pain points for corporations. And they kind of need the one person that's accountable or has the risk for procurement to look at and to sign with. So what we're really doing is we're selling the work as Now or Never and then subcontracting out to all these agencies. And we're taking on kind of more of that risk around the performance of those agencies. And that's really critical, because then the client has one person that they can look at and one person that they can hold accountable, one person to do all the payments to and all that and all the agreements with. And then we manage the rest. So it's kind of like a general contractor type structure where, you know, we're really responsible for doing the scoping of the work, for doing the project management, the day-to-day management, articulating what the requirements are, doing all that kind of behind the scenes management of those vendors to make sure that they're delivering the right things in light of what that kind of bigger strategic vision is. But it's pretty hands off for the client. The client's not there to see us talking to a designer, tweaking a brand or copy on something small. That's just something that we're doing and then delivering. So really it's kind of, in some ways it feels kind of traditional, like a traditional project management about how we're dealing with these vendors, but it all kind of sits with us and our ability to scope and our ability to project manage these different groups towards an outcome.
How do you do that sort of in details? And let's say that a prototype has been created by a design agency or a developer has done some work. Are you still sort of in the forefront to show that to the corporate? Hey, this has been done by our vendors, or do you actually combine and connect them with each other?
Mostly to date, because we do have quite a few freelancers and some others as well, we are mostly the person in the middle for that, because otherwise one of our hypotheses, and so far it's been proven relatively accurate from clients, is that, you know, this isn't their only thing that they're doing on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, sometimes you want it to be, but it isn't. And so being able to actually minimize that amount of work for them and just come back with those outcomes is actually way more valuable to them. So if we're pulling together, even if it's like early in the process focus groups or designers or things like that for concepts and validating those and doing all the testing, they really only care what is the concept and how good is it doing. So we just stay hyper-focused on that and don't get them too involved in the day-to-day how it works. The only exception is when a client wants somebody to learn it. So if they want it more as a capability building, they want their team to learn the skills, they want to upskill their team in these areas, we'll try to find a role for the team member to be part of it. But that's typically the only place where they're kind of getting involved. It's kind of the same as like building a house, which is the best analogy. The customer doesn't really need to be there for the framing. They just want to kind of know framing's complete and look at it. And so that's kind of how we're approaching it.
This venture building like industry is still quite new, I think, and a lot of corporations are not familiar with it. How did you guys do the education part on, you know, when you do your sales pitches, how do you educate people on the services you provide?
It's a good question. We came in bold a year ago where we were like, oh yeah, everybody's going to want this and building ventures is hard and everybody gets this. And this is such an innovative model, and corporates are still pretty scared. Like it's really interesting. So I think there's kind of two pieces. One, finding the right clients. So we call them like kind of bolder, like bold clients, because you need clients that are going to say, I'm okay to take a risk. I've got the authority to take a risk. I've tried this before in other ways and it hasn't worked. And I get it. And finding those types of clients that, you know, are willing to kind of do the right thing, despite kind of how that might affect their career or whatever that looks like, is really challenging. And so we look pretty hard for them within our networks. And a lot of it comes word of mouth and referral from other clients that are saying, this person is kind of like me and I collaborate with this person and talk with this person. They're probably a good fit for you. The second is really using that kind of upfront design thinking work to build up the case. And we found that that's worked really well. So, you know, worst case scenario, the client just kind of gets some really good insights. They get a nice, pretty presentation and some concepts and some landing pages of some products, and they can feel good about it and know that they've got some opinions on the marketplace. Best case scenario, we've really landed on something and they've heard the customer feedback to believe they need to build it now. And it's different enough from their core business that they know that they can't and they need that help. So we've really kind of used, we almost call it like a starter kit. We don't have a good name for it right now, but this kind of design thinking process around the concept creation for the venture as kind of that confidence builder or the case for change creator with clients. And we've been leading with that a lot.
How has that been, especially during this, I mean, pandemic times, you know, everything's remote, I guess, and doing design thinking and doing everything remote. I mean, how is that coming along?
It's actually really good, which is really weird. So I've really enjoyed doing the customer discovery parts remotely. And I, like when we first started, both me and my co-founder were like, oh, we can't do customer interviews if we're not there, like in their house, in their businesses. Like we can't do this. It's gonna be super hard. It's not gonna be great. It has actually been absolutely amazing. So one story, we were doing something with a travel client And obviously travel has gone completely to zero. So they were trying to figure out, you know, what's the future? How can they invest in the next little bit when COVID recovers, and what kind of things could they be building? And we were talking to older generations, and we would zoom into their homes. And you see the banter between the couple as they're getting coffee before the call, or they can't figure out the technology. Just see that dynamic, or the cats jumping across the screen, and you can just actually talk to them a little bit more about their lives, because they've got their art behind you, and you're like, what's that painting? What is that thing? Like, tell me about it. So we found that we actually got to understand the customers in a deeper way in a lot of cases, and we were able to record it all. We were able to get a lot of sound bites, and we were able to really just kind of get closer with them and have these really meaningful conversations. So I've actually really enjoyed doing the customer discovery that way. And then also the kind of geographic dispersion. So we've got another client that's a farm tech, ag tech type company. And the farms are, if I was to drive, it would be 16 hours apart. And so it's really nice. I can be in this part of the country and then that part of the country and that part of the country within 3 hours on Zoom. And so it's made our ability to scale the work and do more interviews and more customer discovery a lot better. Workshops, we've had to really, like design sprints and workshops, we've had to chunk up a lot. So 2 hour blocks spread out over a longer period of time because people just don't have the ability, the Zoom fatigue. But we've got some great facilitators in our network that use Miro and mural boards in ways I could never imagine. And we've actually got some really good outputs from it.
Okay, that's interesting. So actually, do you not always do the workshop, right? So you have other people that you actually bring in and do it and facilitate that?
Typically, we would have done the workshop. But again, we kind of looked at each other and we're like, we're not sure if we're really good at doing this over Zoom. Like, we've never done it over Zoom. And we had somebody in our network that we knew that's been doing a lot of it. And so we tried it. We just said, hey, like, here's the scope and let's collaborate on it. And can you come in and do a Zoom design sprint for us and teach us and facilitate it? And it was awesome. So we kind of admit to, or we're not maybe the best people for things, and just bring those people to the table.
And looking ahead from a sort of talent management perspective, I mean, as two people, do you plan to bring more full time on, or you just keep with that as a service model?
Yeah, the only roles that we've talked about potentially bringing on would be design. Just because, again, a lot of that kind of upfront work around just kind of rapid, fast, scrappy concept creation and kind of iteration. We've got really good freelancers, though, so we don't really have to. It just might be nice to. And the other side would just be a developer potentially. So, again, pushing out those landing pages quickly, pushing out a couple products, and a bit of that kind of CTO guidance to say, are these feasibility estimates as accurate as they need to be? Because there's certain groups that are a little bit more skeptical to do stuff on spec. So you can go bring a product scope to an agency and some of them will say, well, if this goes forward, then I definitely want to be here. I'm not willing to just kind of do a scoping for scoping's sake. And so that's where we've kind of run up across a couple different disciplines, and developers, I think, are the harder one because they're in such high demand that they can kind of say, I don't want to do any speculative scoping or CTO work unless I know for sure I'm going to get the work if it sells. And we can't always guarantee that. So those are kind of the only two areas that we might have to, but we're just kind of doubling down and finding better and more aligned partners instead. And that seems to still be working pretty well for us.
I know when I'm asked about working at a venture builder, people always ask for examples of like companies that I've actually worked on. So I'm just wondering, I mean, you're like not even a year out, but do you have any cool success stories or cool projects that you were happy to put out this year?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we've got a couple. There's a few that I'll talk to, like one that fell off the cutting room floor a little bit. And then there's kind of another one with a pension fund. But one of the things too we're finding is that there's a lot of really cool ideas that we come across when we're doing work with clients. And then the clients actually aren't brave enough to go after them, or they need to do something else first. And so they're not going to kind of solve those problems. So we definitely tried it recently where we had one that was around a kind of a small business bank. And we knew that there's a big problem in Canada around that, but no one was actually solving it. And there's a lot of precedents in Europe, in the US, and all over around what this kind of challenger bank looks like in the business space. So we didn't have a client that wanted to build it, but we thought it should be built. So what we ended up doing was scoping it out, writing a bit of an article about it, and just putting it on LinkedIn and seeing what would happen. And now we have a couple people that have come to us to say that are banks or credit unions, and they said, I love this. We can't build this under our mandate. Could we fund this as a venture to build it? So that's been really interesting to kind of have it go full circle where you're doing the design sprint, you get all your concepts. One just isn't quite feasible for the venture or the corporate falls out. We put it out into the ether. We're not worried about people stealing ideas. Ideas are a dime a dozen, steal them. Execution's the hard part. So we put it out there with a brand and with everything behind it. And then we had a whole bunch of people that came and said, I want to do this as a venture and kind of put their hand up. So we think that's kind of an interesting model to kind of say, we've got this validated thing, but now let's go find the right partner for it. And let's just do that through our network to find that partner, as opposed to keeping it close to our chest and try to sell it and being all academic about who the right partner is. We just kind of let the universe try to figure out who the right partner is. And that's worked actually very well for us. But we've also worked a lot on pensions, both in the UK and the US and Canada, around kind of what the future of that industry looks like and what would a challenger pension look like if you had to redo the entire tech stack, if you had to rethink what it means for decumulating assets. So we've got a couple kind of in Europe around how do you kind of consolidate retirement accounts. There's a couple props that exist like Penfold, but we're pretty far down the line around what does kind of a consolidation product look like, and how do you rethink what the pension experience looks like for retirees, which we think is a really interesting space.
That's interesting. You can almost do like auction out your ideas and be like, hey, who's willing to pay the most for us to implement it for you?
Well, and it's funny because like a lot of people are like, do I have to sign an NDA? Like, what do I have to do? Like all the traditional stuff. And we're like, you know what? A lot of these ideas, almost everyone can get there. You can, if you talk to the same customers, if you do the same work, you're going to find the same pain points. You're going to solve the problems in a similar way. Maybe there'll be some small tweaks or differences, but the real difference between getting a venture out and not is not the idea. So we're not very protective or close to our chest with those. We just really want to find them, find the right people to make them and get them made.
That's interesting. And between the different services, I mean, sound, you know, you do also advisory, venture building, modular projects. I mean, how do you sort of come up with these three pillars as well as, you know, what is where's most of the interest lying?
Yeah, most of the pillars were just kind of what we wanted to do and what we're good at. So not much kind of complexity there. I mean, the hard part is like we do get asked sometimes, will you help us with the innovation management process? Will you help us like figure out how to structure a lab? And that's not really work that we like to do. And so we don't really try to do that. Or you know, sometimes we do turn down work because it's just not interesting to us or it's not our skill sets. And so we just kind of said, what work do we want to do and what work are we good at? And let's do that work. And so that's just kind of how we've structured it. Right now, definitely kind of the design thinking process, and we've kind of got that modified one that's around the inspiration and a bit of market scanning plus the customer discovery seems to be the one that's kind of getting the most traction to start. But building a venture isn't something that you're just like, yeah, I'm going to build one. So I think it's just a natural evolution that you have to go through that process. And then the clients that we did that work with a year ago are now in the process of building the ventures. So it's just a bit of that kind of like lead cycle where we're hoping if we do more of that insight work, we'll get more of the ventures on the back end.
And how many do you have working in parallel in these ventures?
So the full venture builds are definitely more work. So ideally no more than two. Again, it depends on the agencies, but part of it too is us wanting to do good work. And so we realize that, you know, building a venture is full time. Like it really is to do it right, to get it out to market quickly. The insight work, because again, we leverage a lot of different partners and it's a little bit more spaced out over a longer period of time. We can run more of those in parallel and kind of do those in parallel even with the venture. So we try not to have any more than kind of three or four clients at once right now. We could scale that, but we're also just trying to prove that model and do it really well to start.
Yeah, I want to hop back into this agency setup just quickly. I just have a question about it. I'm sure it sounds kind of nice in theory, but I'm sure once you have it in practice, you guys have learned a lot about managing different groups of people working on the same project. Can you just share like some tips for people who are either working with freelancers or looking to outsource parts of their business? Just like how would you suggest that they set that up?
Yeah, and the funny part too is like we've got a couple partners that are in different geographies. Like we did try quite a bit of work with people that were over in the UK, and that it hasn't worked very well. Like it's been very challenging. And so as much as, you know, it's you need to go where the right talent is, we found for certain pieces of work, aligning it with work hours is just, you have to. And you just don't have the same amount of communication. Like I can't pick up the phone in 2 hours and call somebody in Scotland and have a 1 hour jam on something. Like you just can't do that the same way. And so that's kind of the biggest lesson that we found, is just really trying to find people that are in this, in similar jurisdictions and similar time zones. Which we really wanted, we didn't want that. But we've ended up kind of having to land there, whether it's branding agencies or developers or other groups, just because it does make it a lot more challenging. Or we're trying to think, we've got one client in the UK and we're like, do we have to go there? And we're thinking we have to go there because the partners need to be in the UK and we can't be here. It's going to be too challenging. So how do we kind of just align to that? Not necessarily co-located, but at least same time zone. Other than that, though, I think it's just really good kind of communication and structures, really strong briefs. So typically briefs are done for creative agents. Creative kind of fields more so. We're just finding that we're doing way more kind of descriptive briefs in different areas as well. And just trying to be really clear on the scope, really clear on our expectations, really clear on our communication with everybody. And we talk to people a lot. We're on the phone talking to the partners, trying to get, you know, that communication really, really frequent. And we use Slack and we use everything that everyone else does, but nothing kind of replaces just jumping on a Zoom call and talking through stuff. So just over communication, which sounds like really cheesy and cliche, but like it's absolutely true, and just really, really strong scoping and requirements.
And going to maybe, I guess, a bit of a detail here. When it comes to that sort of communication and alignment, do you guys use something like Confluence? Or what kind of tools do you guys use to, I mean, besides Slack, to manage this?
Yeah, so depending on the project, developers will use Confluence and Jira and all of that for sure. And then the groups that organize and work with that are definitely going to use that as well. We're not typically going in and being the product owner at that level of the user stories. We'll still typically find someone to do that. So for us, it's more around how do you communicate that product management vision, bring in the brand, bring in all the creative assets, bring in some of the valuations and the economics into that product management discussion that goes into the PO. So we're not really in Confluence for that part. But every client also has their own tools. Like I hate Microsoft Teams, but we have to use it quite a bit with our clients. So sometimes you're just having to hack it all together. I think I'm probably on Product Hunt at least every day, just kind of being like, what tool can solve this problem for me? And trying to find something, whether it's like, yeah, just random tools to solve random communication or execution problems. So we don't, again, it's not really like a toolbox. And that was one of the things when I was at a big corporation that I really resented, is that there's this kind of like, here's your tools in your toolbox, and this is what you can use. And, you know, we're in this world of bring your own device. I was like, why can't you bring your own tool? There needs to be more of a democratization about like how people work, what works for the project, what works for the people. So again, I don't have a solid answer, but kind of our tech stack and our talent stack change with each project, just to kind of suit whatever those requirements are. And sometimes, again, working with pension funds or others, sometimes the data requirements and where data can be stored get really complicated. And sometimes it just, you have to use Microsoft Teams.
It would it be possible, some of these, it would be interesting from my perspective as well, like what are some of these problems that you have identified where you're just looking for a tool, but you couldn't really find one?
Oh, that's a good question. One area that like we sometimes struggle with is more on the customer discovery side, that I'd love for someone to create, but I don't really want to create it. Is just how to actually find high quality customers to chat with in other geographies. So it's one thing if you're doing customer discovery on an existing customer set where you can go through that, you can do a call out, you can tap people on the shoulder, you can find the people that were noisy and called the help desk and complained. And that's easy enough. If a good example is like if we wanted to solve a pension problem for rural Scottish elders, how do we go find them quickly and cheaply. And so we've done, you know, Facebook ads, Craigslist, like you do all the things that you're supposed to do to try to find these people, hire recruiters. But hiring recruiters is very expensive. Mm-hmm. And so, and it still takes a while because I have to go find them. So I'd love to figure out easier ways to get access to people that want to chat with you that are in weird segments and niches. And I'd say that's one area that probably takes us longer and is more expensive than we'd like. And then kind of on the venture building side, dev agencies are, they're very expensive right now. And so just finding more of those, you've kind of got a mix between full stop, full service, like MVP builders that are charging huge amounts of money and in huge hourly rates, or these kind of like offshore find a dev type things where it's just like one dev in the Ukraine and you have to manage them. There's not a whole bunch in the middle. And so I'd love to find kind of more CTOs for hire, freelance CTOs that are really ready to invest and aren't going to charge $500 an hour. And so that you can kind of figure out what that scope for that MVP needs to look like quickly. And you're not over engineering it, but you're also not just getting some random single dev somewhere that may or may not be a good fit. So those are kind of the two points that we're struggling with a little bit is kind of around the scrappiness around getting the insights and then getting the scoping and a quick product out.
Cool. You've been in this like sort of innovation corporate, I don't know, diversification space for a long time, both as a consultant and then like starting a venture and now this venture builder. What are some mistakes people make, a lot of companies make when it comes to the innovation projects to keep their business growing?
Oh God, there's so many. I think the first one I'll say again is just talent. I see a lot of times, and it was one of the ones I wrote about, but high performers don't equal the right person for an innovation role. So one thing I find is that, you know, you've got somebody that's flown around the organization a little bit and they're a high performer. They're really good at office politics. Maybe they ran a really successful IT implementation project, or they were in another group and they were young and they're high performer. And like, to be fair, this is kind of the path that I took. So I'm kind of being kind of critical of my own path and how I kind of got to where I am. But a lot of times these people are really good at office politics, following rules, following policies, running meetings, all these things that make them really good at in a corporate world. And then they get pushed into this innovation world. And, you know, one of the things too I find is that they're really good, because typically a middle manager, really good at taking what someone says and executing it. But one of the things that I've noticed is that a lot of innovation leaders and don't have a vision and they don't really have that kind of fire beneath them. And there needs to be kind of this bigger purpose and why you're getting out of bed every day to go work on really hard stuff and fight the organization, because you're going to have to. And so a lot of people try to play within the lines and make everyone happy and still be a good corporate person while being an innovator. And I don't think those go together. One of my friends is doing a thesis for his master's and he's looking at a bunch of digital transformations where people have totally changed their tech stack within banking. And he said that most people, after they do that, quit the organization because it's just so exhausting and they burn some bridges ultimately. So if you have these people that are really good at the corporate, that have been there forever and have aspirations to be a CEO, and you put them in these disruptive roles, they're going to be at this kind of juxtaposition around, do I want to be successful in my longer term career or do I want to be successful in this role? And sometimes you can't do both. So I see just the wrong people getting tasked with it and not having enough opinions or kind of areas to focus on. And then the second one that I kind of see is that, you know, it's sometimes it's just tech for tech's sake. Like that's the easy thing, is go find a lot of fintech or go find ag tech and do a bunch of partnerships and just do stuff. And you see innovation teams just do stuff. Mm. And sometimes it's, you know, just kind of tech oriented or whatever that is. But I do think it really strong innovations within a corporate context need to combine. Yes, customers have to love them and you have to do that customer discovery work. A lot of innovators and corporations are really scared to talk to customers. Not okay. It has to be good for the organization. It has to align to strategy and it has to make money. It has to be profitable. And a lot of innovators are like, well, you know, blockchain is cool, or we can solve a world hunger problem, or we can solve this like thing, which is fine. But if you can't translate that into what's actual economics behind this thing and think through how the tech architecture and everything actually matters to the business, it doesn't really matter in the end. And then you also need the tech. But I think not everyone kind of, it's that mini CEO role where you have to think through the risk, the economics, the product, the marketing, the distribution, the whole thing to make something work. And a lot of times innovation teams are just finding tech and saying, I found a tech, it's cool. And then like throwing it over to the head of something who looks at the tech and is like, oh yeah, that's cool. And that's it. And I don't think that's what really makes strong innovation within corporates.
Yeah, I think we call that innovation theater.
Yeah. Oh yeah, an innovation theater. That's another one. Like endless workshops, crowdsourcing ideas, like all that sort of stuff are not my favorite things because you get just a lot of incremental stuff. And I don't believe that everyone should be an innovator or everyone can. I think design thinking with workers to understand a process is very different than crowdsourcing ideas. So yeah, innovation theater is one that we don't do it. People ask us to go do workshops just to kind of facilitate things with people and come up with ideas and sticky notes. And half the time we joke that we just put sticky notes on the wall and say like, oh, we're just going to put it up there, blockchain, and like, you know, a tip.
Yeah.
Instead of getting a payment where you're going to tip us and to do a payment model. And so like, we can already guess what everyone's going to come up with. It's pretty consistent. So we don't see a lot of value in it.
So to become an innovator, or let's say, which sort of resources or books or frameworks have really helped you in the past years in your role?
Yeah, no, I think like I love learning new frameworks. I don't follow them religiously or academically, but I think having the base to understand them, to be able to apply them out is really interesting. The ones that we kind of rinse and repeat, like strategic foresight is actually one that we kind of start with in a lot of cases to say, how do we really look at the market in an interesting way and the business context in an interesting way to frame our design thinking? And then just really knowing the design thinking process. I think that's just so critical to the point where it's almost internalized, where it's not kind of this thing where you have to follow a process. Like you just get it and you do it. And it's just part of it. Like there's no world where you could imagine not talking to a customer. You need to kind of build that muscle where it's just, that's what you do. That's always really good. I listen to just like, again, podcasts. Like I tend not to read a lot of business books anymore. I used to. I find that they always kind of say like the nice stuff around it. It's like, no one's going to say that they're a bad leader. No one's going to say that they like really messed something up. It's always kind of like the fairy tale version of like any story. Whereas I find sense of podcasts and definitely like scanning, I've probably got like 30 notification, like different kind of feed things on Medium. Trying to find those examples of people that are actually kind of talking more practically or about what's failed, I think always works a lot better and you learn a lot more. So those would be kind of the places that I try to do that more micro learning, I guess, like read a lot every day and try to find those kind of more stories from interesting people that might not be the Guy Kawasaki's or, you know, the Steve Jobs and learning. Like it's, if you look at the unicorns, it's not really always applicable to your day to day. So I try to find the people that aren't unicorns and go listen to them. And again, talking to lots of people. I read something the other day that like you should try to talk to like two or three interesting people a week. And I think that's really accurate. Like you never know what you're going to learn from somebody or from someone's business or from talking to somebody and just doing a meet and greet coffee. And so I probably over index away from like kind of books nowadays into more of the talking to people and just reaching out to people on LinkedIn and such. But I mean, there's so many classic books like Innovator's DNA or Crossing the Chasm, like it, or Blue Ocean Strategy. Like all those are really cool frameworks that are good to have in your back pocket that you can pull out when you need. But now it's kind of more around the nitty gritty and like actually how do you build some of this stuff?
Cool. I guess we're coming to the end here. Just wanted to hear about what you're looking forward to the next year from now or never. What are you excited about in 2021?
Yeah, for sure. I think we're hoping to have a bit more kind of geographic distribution this year with some of our clients. So we're trying to get a few more in the US and a few more in the UK. And I'm really excited about the fact that, you know, being, you know, even where you're based doesn't really matter as much anymore. So I'm really excited about that. And just kind of trying to run through and take advantage of the last little bits of COVID before hopefully we're in the home stretch and being able to kind of do that work that way. But kind of our big goal is like, we kind of want to have one of these homegrown ventures. So that venture that we kind of threw out into the world, we think we can structure that one in a really different way. So, you know, separate from all these big corporates, but invested by these corporates And we want to have one or two of those launched this year would be the goal. So we're going to do the corporate venture work for our clients and build those and support those. But they just inevitably go slower. So we're hoping that we can build a couple ourselves and just get those out into the world. So that's kind of what we're sprinting at right now. It's a lot of work. And yeah. So hopefully 2021, we'll have a few more kind of finished case studies that we can actually talk about, because they're not in progress on our website.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very cool. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I guess last question is also, you know, how can our listeners connect with you?
For sure. LinkedIn's always a good way, just Alex Newth, and then NUTH, or you can just go to our website, nowornever.network. We don't have a ton on there though, so that's just more if you want to reach out to us. And then on there, we've got links to some of our Medium blog posts and things like that are always a little punchy. And we do tend to do a little bit of a kind of non-traditional commentary on LinkedIn as well. So if you follow us on LinkedIn, now or never, you'll find that too.
It's always a fresh perspective. It's good to hear.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the same thing everyone else is saying. Yeah.
usually, we take some, we throw a couple punches, but it always gets some good conversation going.
Well, cool. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for coming on.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much. All right. Have a good day. Or good night, I guess.
Thank you very much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed it. Our captivating theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send a guest recommendation, drop us a line at launch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Matthias or myself on LinkedIn. Have a great one and see you next time on Launch and Learn.
One more anecdote, actually. I saw that you were named like this most powerful woman in Canada in 2018. Quick story. How did that come about, and how did that happen? What did that mean to you?
Yeah, for sure. So it's just an award that they do in Canada, recognizing women that have kind of done crazy stuff. So I got that one from the work I did with Brightside, so building the Challenger Bank. Partially too, because when I built that, I was in Western Canada, which in Canada is kind of like the cowboy area. And so we're not as cool as Toronto, and not as kind of, typically we're a bit of the underdogs. And so launching something like that, that was pretty big and pretty disruptive from Western Canada was something that definitely got on their radars. So cool. That was how that one originated.
Oh, very cool.
It's a nice honor to have put on your wall.
Yeah.